You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Tolerance Week is a time when all of us can look a little harder at how our actions affect others and the world around us. In Siouxland next week, there are several speakers and events scheduled that focus on tolerance and intolerance. A lot of residents in Sioux County came out last week to accuse 4th District Republican Congressman Steve King of some intolerance. King's controversial comment made on Twitter over 2 weeks ago continues to reverberate throughout his rural 39-county congressional district. A group of constituents in the most conservative corner of the state took a stand against the Republican congressman, saying that King's support for a homogenous culture does not reflect Iowa values.
But I have long contemplated the idea just going to the floor and saying, John Lewis, thank you for your contribution to civil rights during the civil rights era. I would appreciate it if you would contribute something since that. It's been a half a century.
I think there's been far too much focus on race, especially in the last 8 years. And I want to see that put behind us. And I want to be as bonded together. I gave
For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that they weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert. Those people.
But where did any other subgroup of people contribute more to civilization?
Than white people?
Than Western civilization itself, that's rooted in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and the United States of America, and every place where the footprint of Christianity settled the world.
Asia?
That's all of Western civilization.
Oh,
he has been accused of supporting white nationalism, of being bigoted, racist, and xenophobic. He is Representative Steve King. His latest incendiary remarks sparked widespread ire and outrage when he praised a far-right anti-immigrant Dutch politician, saying on Twitter, quote, "We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies." 14 years after electing him to Congress, it seems the people of Iowa's 4th Congressional District have grown apathetic toward his headline-grabbing antics. They handed him 80% of the vote in the general election. But this time around, King's comments drew protest in an unlikely place. In Sioux County, the most conservative county in Iowa, nearly 150 people gathered outside the courthouse on a cold, cloudy Saturday morning to let it be known that King's views do not represent them. The flags whipped in the wind throughout the 30-minute Sioux County Assembly for Diversity, a nonpartisan event featuring 5 speakers. Jim Scopp, a retired English professor, spoke about a time 10 to 15 years ago when he watched a grocery store clerk struggling to communicate with 2 Hispanic customers. When they walked away, she muttered to the white folks in line,
"Learn the language. When you come to our country, at least learn the language." I would have liked to tell her that 180 years ago there were Native Americans here who gave Iowa its name, but now live in Kansas and Oklahoma because we threw them out. You see, we have a history of prejudice. I would have liked to say that almost assuredly her great-grandparents or grandparents needed help shopping at Lamar's or Rock Rapids because they didn't know English. That as late as 1950s, men and women in the streets of Orange City or Sioux Center still used the Dutch language, a half century or more after immigration from the Netherlands stopped for the First World War. We have a history of prejudice, a history we've created and even suffered, but we don't have to tolerate it. And that's why we're here this morning, and that's why our representative, Steve King, a man we elected, has not only got to listen, but also to staunch the poison that he creates. Thank you.
The event was coordinated in part by Steve Marr, a local coffee shop owner who has been known to shake things up in this conservative community that exudes what you might call Iowa nice. At the Old Factory Coffee Shop, he hosts live music, poetry slams, and most recently, community conversations that elevated the voices of Muslims.
My wife will even say that to me, like, "Oh, you're really gonna get in trouble this time." And I'm like, "No, I'm not." Like, everybody just, if they don't like what I have to say, they're like, "That's just, you know," they say to me what they say about Steve King, you know.
That's just Steve being Steve.
He lives in a place where pleasantries and politeness prevail, alongside a certain restraint and aversion to confrontation. After all, the person you just tailgated or gossiped about in aisle 4 might work at the only grocery store within 15 miles, or worse, they might go to your church. Marr, who grew up in Joliet, Illinois, went to college in Orange City and chose to put down roots here, knowing his liberal views would be among the minority in a county that overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump.
My friends, they move up to Minneapolis and they're like, oh yeah, you should move up to someplace like where we're at because everyone agrees with you. And I'm like, that's not fun to me. Like, I'm not challenged by that.
This blood red county, the very place where Trump declared during his campaign that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and not lose any voters, this county can be a challenging place to live for those on the other end of the political spectrum and people of color. The U.S. Census Bureau's 2015 American Community Survey showed Sioux County was 88.3% white alone. Latinos are among a growing minority, representing 9.6% of the population. When a Muslim man from Morocco considered moving to Sioux County, he heard stories about this foreign land like,
you're not Dutch, you're not much, there is no bar, you know? They have no movie theater that I couldn't believe, you know? And they're backward, and, you know.
Saeed Ben Saeeda married a farmer's daughter, and he was embraced by this, quote, backward town. During the assembly, he thanked nearly a dozen community members by name for fending off racism, helping him find a good job, plowing the snow in his driveway, teaching him how to fly, and treating him like family for the past 22 years.
So why was I calling this place home? It's because of its people who opened their hearts to me and gave me a chance to exist in their surroundings, to exist.
Even though the Sioux County Assembly for Diversity was deliberately planned and described as nonpartisan, some still perceived it as a little too progressive for these parts. And that was enough to bring dissent among families.
People were messaging me all throughout the week as we were planning this and saying, I'm trying to invite my family along, and they're upset with me that I'm even going.
Those that did go heard from people like Mimi Sambolt. She is an active member in the community, a mother of three, and an immigrant from Mexico.
I'm married to a Sioux County Dutch farmer, and we've made pretty nice babies. My desire is to raise up my kids to be proud to be an American like I am.
Sharing in the values of this rural community, she is involved in not one, but two churches. Carmel Reformed, which was started by Dutch immigrants in 1896, and Amistad Christiana, established nearly 100 years later to serve a new wave of immigrants, Spanish-speaking Latinos.
This is who I am. I feel very accepted, fully accepted in Sioux County. And instead of tweeting out racist comments, legislators should be working on immigration reform.
Of the people who spoke at the assembly, only one was born and raised in Sioux County. The outlier was Laura Hightrader, a lifelong Republican who read an open letter to King detailing her family's immigrant experience. Like many in Sioux County, her grandfather came from the Netherlands. Her father was a first-generation American. Her husband's ancestors tipped over their covered wagon outside of Boyden, Iowa, and spent their first winter on the land where she now lives.
Somehow, Mr. King, you have gotten the idea that immigrants and their children are a threat to American civilization. The very civilization that immigrants like my ancestors and yours built. You're not talking about immigrants that look like us. You're talking about immigrants that look like my two youngest children, who are immigrants from Ethiopia.
Her frustration with King mounted when he doubled down on his tweet in an interview with CNN's Chris Cuomo.
Well, of course, I meant exactly what I said, as it always is the case, Chris. And I've said the same thing as far as 10 years ago to the German people and to any population of people that is a declining population that isn't willing to have enough babies to reproduce themselves. And I've said to them, you cannot rebuild your civilization with somebody else's babies. You've got to keep your birth rate up, and that you need to teach your children your values. And in doing so, then you can grow your population and you can strengthen your culture, you can strengthen your way of life.
Mar sees strength in diversity and the potential to, quote, foster hope instead of fear, to rebel rouse apathy toward action, to acknowledge our sameness and celebrate differences.
A friendship that I am developing in the last year is a guy that just sits on the opposite side of the bar from me when I'm working, and we disagree about everything, but we can have a beer together and challenge each other. Instead of being enemies that disagree about everything, we become friends and support each other and help each other be better community members. And if we're not going to do that, if I'm just going to bail, then I can't actually believe in unity. Like, I just have to believe that, oh, well, we actually do need homogenous communities of here where the progressives live and here where the conservatives live, and we can't live together. And I don't want to believe that.
For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Ellie Carson.
And the most important verse was the one they made up in Montgomery, Alabama. Said, we are not afraid. There's a lot of people in this world, they know what's right and what's wrong, but they're not gonna do anything about it. Somebody has to be willing to sing, we are not afraid.
We are not afraid.
Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A well-known advocate of tolerance will visit Siouxland next week. Inga Auerbacher is a Holocaust survivor. She was liberated from a concentration camp when she was just a child and has spent most of her life in America. The Sioux City Community Theater will perform a play based on her life story next Thursday. The children's production of The Star on My Heart is the story of Auerbacher, who was sent to the Theresienstadt camp during World War II. Auerbacher says this play focuses on what happened after she was liberated from the camp.
We were liberated on May 8, 1945, by the Soviet, the Russian army. And it wasn't quite easy, because even at the end, the Nazis, the people who were still there, the personnel and the soldiers and the SS, they were throwing hand grenades into the camp on the last day, and one almost hit me, and they were running away. Now, the camp did not have too many people anymore at that time, because most of the people were sent to the east, mainly Auschwitz. Theresien existed, or Theresienstadt existed, from 1941 to 1945. I came there in 42, and it had altogether about 140,000 people, among them 15,000 children. And among those children, very, very few survived. Some say 1%, some say 10%. Anyway, it was extremely little, especially the children under the age of 15, which I was. I would say out of those 140,000 people, two-thirds would be shipped out to the killing centers like Auschwitz, which was the next camp that they used. There were other places, too. They sent them up, some of them. Even one transport went up to Riga in Latvia. They sent them to the Lublin area in Poland, very far. But most of them were sent to Auschwitz. The camp was actually set up as a transit place. You put them in for a while, like a stockade, and then like animals, and then you ship them out, the ones who didn't die there. So about two-thirds would be shipped out to the killing centers, close to a third died there, and very few thousand survived at the end. Now, the place was actually set up to show the world all the intelligentsia, all the highly decorated war veterans, the best doctors, the best lawyers, the best artists, musicians were sent there to keep them a while, to sort of tell the world, oh, they're in one place, they're very safe, but of course they weren't. My father was a disabled war veteran from World War I. He fought in the German army, was wounded quite badly in his right arm, shoulder actually, And that is why we were sent there. We were had our numbers already to go to other places like Riga in Latvia, where my grandmother was sent. And we got out of that transfer just in the last few days. And but then that was in 41. We had an order to go to Riga. And but we got out of that one, and then we were sent in 1942 in August to Terezin or Theresienstadt. I was the youngest in a transport of close to 1,200 people. At the end of 3 years, as my mother told me, there were about 13 people who survived. Some people say a few more, but very few. And I was 10 years old at that time. I was the only child from the state of Württemberg, southern Germany, with the capital is Stuttgart, who was sent, deported from Stuttgart. That was the main gathering place for the whole state. I'm the only child who returned from any of the transports that started out in Stuttgart. I didn't have much schooling. Because Jewish children were not allowed to go to the regular school where they were living. There was only one Jewish school for the whole state of Württemberg in Stuttgart. Well, pure luck. Some people say, well, God had his hand on you, and he looked at you and said, you got to survive. But I don't like to believe that, because God, this is always the question. Was God responsible? Who was responsible for that? And of course, the clergy, a lot of the clergy say God gave a free will, and we did it to ourselves, the people themselves. Who's to live, who's to die? Now, of course, that's so questionable. And I don't know. I survived only really because of luck. I can say that luck was the answer for surviving. Of course, some of my religious friends will say, well, you were chosen to tell the story. But there were so many other children or adults who could have done maybe even a better job than I. But I feel very blessed, I will say that. And I have not, floundered that opportunity because I was alive. I felt a special burden and on myself and a mission to tell the story of what happened to us, especially for the children. 1.5 million children were killed in the Nazi Holocaust, Jewish children, and those 3 million children's eyes still haunt me. Now, I like to speak of the Holocaust not only of 6 million Jews, Jews were the main victims of this catastrophe, but there were 5 million others whom I like to include, to Christians, Gypsies, people with mental and physical difficulties, Jehovah's Witnesses, some Poles. But the main hatred was the Jews.
Does it bother you today when you see certain groups, like Muslim groups in the United States, or people who want to come to the United States, being kept out, being treated as if they're the enemy?
Well, I tell you, I live in Jamaica, Queens. Queens is the most diverse place in the whole country. And I live in a row house. My next door neighbor is a devout Muslim family from Bangladesh, the walls touch. The other side is a Hindu family from Guyana, which was at one time British Guyana. They came from India at one time, and they're devout Hindus. Also, the walls touch. I am friends with both sides. In four houses where I live, you have the four religions of the world, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, and Christian, and we all get along very well. What bothers me the most right now is the resurgence of anti-Semitism in the whole world, including America. It's so hard for me to think that over 70 years, this terrible thing could happen again. I hope not, because this is, in, especially in my country, I'm a very proud American citizen. And yes, I was German-born, but they took my citizenship away, and I could get it back at this point. But I feel I'm an American. It was almost, I would feel like betraying my wonderful country. I don't need more than one citizenship, and that is the American one. And what bothers me the most is not only, is not even the, yes, refugees, of course, we were refugees. We were looking for a home. And you have to also, I mean, we have been, people have come to this country to hurt us. Not just to look at America as a refuge. Yes, people who are searching a refuge to save their lives should be admitted, but they have to be checked out, that they are not people coming in here to hurt us, but really people who are searching for a new home to save their lives. That's what we want, we're looking for. Unfortunately, that didn't happen to us.
When you go to
absolutely too much hatred today, too much. And that comes from lack of knowledge, stereotyping. I don't stereotype. I always, when I speak in schools all over the world, really, I'm going now to New Zealand and Australia. I've been in Scotland. I've been all over the place. And I always tell the people, look, don't stereotype. Not all Muslims are bad people. My Muhammad next door is a wonderful man and his family. Wonderful. And one has to get to know other people intimately, like invite them in for dinner, go to their churches. I've been to many mosques. I've been to many Hindu temples. They came to my synagogue. Share. Get to know other people. And don't believe in lie-telling, falsehoods being spoken. That's very important to me. Yes, of course, it's important with these refugees. It brings back memories of how hard we tried to get into America or any other country to save our lives, not even to look for a better living condition, better economy. We were looking to save our lives. And that was not given to us.
That was Inga Auerbacher, a survivor of the Holocaust, a play based on her experiences in a Nazi concentration camp called A Star on My Heart, will play next Thursday through Saturday, April 7th through the 9th, at the Orpheum Theater. The Sioux City Community Theater's Children's Theater will perform the play. The writer and theater director, Angela Millerl Hansen, and Inga Auerbacher will be present at the Sioux City opening night. Ms. Auerbacher will be the guest of honor and speak to the audience after the performance. She'll also speak to students in Siouxland about her experiences. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While stories about World War II and survivors of the Holocaust have become more well-known over the years, the events of the First World War have faded somewhat. 100 years ago, the United States entered the war and many Iowa soldiers trained at Camp Dodge near Des Moines. The camp is open for tours and has a special exhibit about life there during the war. Michael Vogt is the curator of the museum, and he's coming to Siouxland this Sunday to talk about Camp Dodge, the museum exhibit, and life there during the war. Vogt says more than 110,000 soldiers came through Camp Dodge during the war. Most, but not all, were from the upper Midwest.
There were some soldiers here that African-American soldiers that came from Alabama and trained as part of the 366 Infantry, but the majority of the soldiers that trained at Camp Dodge were part of the 88th Infantry Division. That division was set up and organized here at Camp Dodge from scratch, and they began inducting recruits in September 1917, and they would train with the 88th Division, which worked in the capacity of a training division where personnel would learn their jobs, complete basic training, and then be deployed to other divisions already serving in France. In July of 1918, the 88th Division received orders to deploy to France as a full division, and they recruited up to full strength and left the end of July 1918 for France.
Now, the men were trained in trench warfare, and that's not something a lot of maybe younger people have any idea of what that is or what that's about. Can you explain that a little bit, what the training was like?
The weapons at hand at that time were more lethal than anything other soldiers had faced on the battlefield prior to World War I. High explosive shells, rapid fire artillery, bolt action rifles, machine guns took a dreadful toll in human life. And once the armies had stopped maneuvering and advancing as the Germans drove into France in the early months of World War I, they dug into the positions that they had gained, and both sides ended up into a gridlock situation where they dug into the ground to defend their positions, and they dug into the ground essentially trenches several hundreds of yards deep and all the way from the Swiss border to the North Sea. And in simplest terms, they dug into the ground to protect themselves from bullets and shrapnel and bombs and shells.
You had trenches there. I imagine these took up quite a lot of land, quite a lot of space.
Yeah, there was about I can't remember the exact acreage, but maybe a couple of acres at Camp Dodge were the location of a trench training facility where they actually did dig trenches and use them for instructional purposes. French officers were sent to the United States to instruct and tutor their American students in the techniques and tactics of trench warfare.
I know that both Camp Dodge and I believe there's Camp Des Moines, both of these were really at that point desegregated in a way because they trained both white and African-American soldiers. Is that correct?
Yes and no. The Army was still segregated at that time, and it would be until the late 40s when President Harry Truman, through executive order, desegregated the military. But Fort Des Moines is unique because it was the host of the first black officer candidate school, which graduated a little over 600 black officers in October of 1917. Camp Dodge was also the induction site for African Americans, about 3,000 of that would become the 366th Infantry Regiment. And they would later leave Camp Dodge in June of 1918. They arrived in November 1917 and saw service in combat with the 92nd Division in France. So Camp Dodge, can't really say it broke the color barrier, but it certainly did its part to train African Americans that would see service on the Western Front during the war.
I was reading an article about the influx of African Americans that came up to the Des Moines area and up to Camp Dodge, and much was made of the fact that Des Moines and Iowa was a different kind of place. It wasn't the South. Was that true? I mean, how were they welcomed, or were they welcomed?
They were. It's an interesting situation. It would be incorrect for me to say that racism didn't exist in Iowa at that time, but it was not as prevalent, and it was not as, I would say, widespread as far as in terms of Jim Crow laws that or white fountains and black fountains, etc., that you would encounter in the South.
Now, this is a Gold Star Military Museum. What exactly
Correct.
Does that mean?
In the First World War, an Army officer from Ohio was very proud of the fact that he had two sons that were serving in the Army, and he designed a flag to hang in his window to demonstrate that pride. It was essentially a white rectangle with a red border and two blue stars sewn on it to represent his two sons. This style became very popular, and other people bought them. There are some other variations of this original design, and they were hung in windows and storefronts, etc., across the country. Once the United States began to commit troops and they arrived in France in the fall of 1917, United States troops began to incur casualties on the West Front. Merle Hay from Glidden, Iowa, was the first American and one of the first three men to die in combat. So they adapted those blue star flags by sewing a gold star over top the blue so that the blue provided a border and the gold star was more prominent. The gold star, of course, symbolizing from that time to the present day, someone who dies serving in the military in wartime.
What are some other things that people might see at this exhibit?
We have a reconstructed trench where you can walk through a pair of burlap curtains. The trench diorama is disguised behind the facade of a shelled-out French building. So you can walk in and you'll hear shell fire carrying overhead, bursts of machine gun fire. Embedded in the trench walls are exhibit cases showing the types of uniforms and equipment and weapons that were used by not only enemy soldiers, but American personnel, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, during the First World War.
That was Michael Vogt, the curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum located on Camp Dodge in Johnston, Iowa. He'll be speaking this Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Sioux City Public Museum. He'll also show a lot of photos from the camp's heyday during World War I.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The latest pick for the One Book, One Siouxland reading program is Ray Kinsella's Shoeless Joe. It's a story about Iowa corn farmer Ray Kinsella, who hears a voice telling him, if you build it, he will come.
What are you grinning at, you ghost?
If you build it, he will come.
And that was a clip from the movie adaptation of the book Field of Dreams. The film explores many issues, including the devastation of the farm crisis. The crisis came to a head in the mid-80s as farmland prices declined and banks called in delinquent loans for land and equipment. Basically, many farmers owed more than they were worth. As part of the One Book, One Siouxland project, Morningside College is hosting a forum called Field of Nightmares, the Farm Crisis of the 1980s and its Impact on Iowa, Thursday, March 30th, in the Weichert Auditorium in the Bueller Ralphs Hall. Panelists will be a retired farm journalist and a banker who had to deal with the effects of the crisis from the other side of the ledger. The issue was timely for two reasons, according to Tom Paulson, associate professor and chair of Applied Agricultural and Food Studies at Morningside.
Back in the 1980s, we were coming off of a very interesting economic time with very, very high interest rates. A lot of farm ground had been leveraged against. In other words, farmers had a lot of loans against the property. And when we had a real pretty serious bump in the economy, what happened is land prices began to fall very, very quickly. And so many farmers' net worth was based upon, or their equity was based upon, the value of that land. Pretty soon their land values weren't carrying the loans that they needed to continue to operate, and it put the entire farming system across the country, but with serious impacts here in Iowa and the tri-state area, put those farmers in a real bad situation for being able to obtain operating capital to continue their farming operations.
How does that inform how we think about agriculture today, you know, and how the farm economy in general is? How does that inform how we think about agriculture and the general farm economy today?
Well, it's certainly very, very important, because we've seen, especially now in light of recent land values, the last 3 years, our land values have continued to go down. And that's the first time that's happened since the farm crisis. So there's a lot of people speculating what that really means, but it certainly has an impact on how lenders lend and how borrowers need to be positioned and have their businesses set so that they are in a position to have operating capital and credit available in their farming operations. Our students here in the Applied Ag and Food Studies program at Morningside College are studying the various aspects of agribusiness management, and they've had a chance to look at what does it mean, what do equity positions mean, what do their balance sheets look like. When we start comparing farming operations and looking at the income and cash flow ramifications of what happens in the marketplace, we're coming off of $7 corn 3 and 4 years ago. So we had a very, very high market, and now our market is a little bit depressed on the grain side. And so again, and the livestock have followed. And again, a lot of that, I think, is due to, and I'm not an economist, but a lot of that's due to what's happening to land prices overall right now. And so those things have an impact on farmers. They certainly have an impact on our students. And then,
so are you going to be talking about these issues at your presentation?
Part of this presentation is to help our students understand what it was like at that time. And one thing that we've done with this is we've partnered with One Book, One Siouxland in their reading of Shoeless Joe. And of course, everyone's familiar with the Iowa Field of Dreams and the movie The Field of Dreams with Kevin Costner. But in that movie, you'll recall that, you know, our lead character, Ray Kinsella, is about to lose his farm. And this book was actually being written in the early 80s during that time when this was a very weighing theme for everyone in the state of Iowa and the Midwest, for that matter. But what we're trying to accomplish with that connection with One Book, One Siouxland is to help people understand the character and what was happening to him at that time and how he may have felt. And our panelists both lived through this same time in different roles. And so Steve Schmidt, who is currently Vice President and Chief Credit Officer for Security National Bank here in town, he was a bank president in Orange City, Iowa during this time and lived through that from the banker's side of things. And Cheryl Tevis, farmer and retired farm journalist with Successful Farming magazine, wrote about it and lived through it as a farmer. Both of them are Morningside graduates. It's given us a chance to bring them back to campus and share their perspectives of what has taken place through that time through their eyes. And I think it'll be a really interesting discussion. It'll be very eye-opening for a lot of our students who haven't really studied this time frame to see what similarities we might have with today. And certainly will be an eye-opener for a lot of people in the greater Siouxland area in better understanding the character in Shoeless Joe.
Is it more important for, you know, today's younger farmers to have a focus on business and economics?
Absolutely critical. Absolutely critical. Farmers are some of the best business minds that I know. They have to be, because farming is a very difficult business because of the things that, you know, that are out there that they have to deal with. But our students have to understand that. And again, they're learning a lot of the basics of that right now in our program here at Morningside College. This spring, we're teaching the Ag Business Management course, and we're teaching the Futures and Risk Management course. And the students are learning a lot of those various aspects, how to calculate profits, how to market correctly, and the tools that they can use to market properly, and then looking at this from a big picture perspective. But they have to have those skill sets to be successful. And we hope that we're giving them some of that basic information now that they'll be able to apply as they go out into the real world.
So is it doable to go into farming these days if you don't already have some land?
There's certainly opportunities for young farmers that don't have access to land. Matter of fact, we have another Morningside Campus Event Series presentation on April 3rd. Dave Baker from the Iowa State University and Outreach Beginning Farmer Center in Urbandale, Iowa, will be here to talk to our students during the Ag Business Management class. And then that evening, on April 3rd at 7 o'clock, we will have a community discussion. Well, he will have a presentation on what are some of the ways that young farmers can get into farming. And what he does really, and I don't want to tell too much of his story, but he has a wonderful story. Actually, he was in the Navy, and when he got out of the Navy and retired, he wanted to farm, but he did not have access to farmland. And so he actually tells his story about how he went and met with some farmers who did not have anybody to pass their land on to, and developed a working arrangement with them to actually buy into the farming operation over a series of years. And that's kind of his story, but now that's his role. He matches young farmers with people that don't have anyone to transfer land to help keep young farmers in farming and get them into farming. So absolutely there are opportunities and programs out there that we can help facilitate that process. And I think it's really, really important that we keep young people engaged in the farming operation.
Looking back at the farm crisis of the 80s, is there any way that that could have been avoided?
No, absolutely wasn't. But you think about that, it was a perfect storm of events that took place, you know, and everything kind of hit at the same time. And it certainly, we have seen and heard the stories. And again, we're going to have a chance to see and hear some of those stories of what happened and what they felt during that time frame. But yeah, there are just so many variables in that. But we look back throughout history and we've had similar events to that happen back in the 1930s. My wife's family, her great-grandfather lost his farm at that time. I certainly had family friends that lost their farm in the 80s, and we can go back through history and see a lot of events like that. I think most recently we think about the housing era in 2008 when we saw the housing dump in prices, and that had quite an impact on a lot of people as well. Maybe not quite so much in the Midwest. We might have been buffered a little bit from that here, whereas I think in the early 80s, I think some of the coasts were buffered a little bit from what was going on the farm crisis side. But it all plays together, and it's important that we understand our history to keep from repeating those same mistakes again. And that's really the purpose of some of these presentations we have for our students, is to help them understand that and to make comparisons to where we are today.
Along with all of the economic issues, do today's farmers have to think a lot more about environmental issues, you know, about sustainable farming?
Oh, absolutely. Our farmers are more sustainable than they've ever been. They're more profitable than they've ever been. They're more economically savvy than they've ever been. They have to manage all those different aspects, and there's constantly new things coming at them all the time, and they have to be able to understand how those fit into the bigger picture, not only from a productivity side, but from an economic side. So we can be extremely productive and have very, very high yields, but not be very productive or very profitable. And so balancing those issues and understanding how to do that is critically important. And again, we really strive to work with our students to help them understand that as they move forward into the ag industry.
That was Tom Paulson, associate professor and chair of Applied Agricultural and Food Studies at Morningside College. He's helping host a program called Field of Nightmares, the Farm Crisis of the 1980s and its Impact on Iowa, at 7 p.m. Thursday at the Weichert Auditorium in Bueller Ralphs Hall on the Morningside campus.
Here's to the farmer, the plants, the fields, and the spring that turn from green to that harvest honey. Hold one up for the banker downtown that got him on his feet.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This weekend, the Sioux City International Film Festival continues after a snowstorm cut the event short last month. The festival's Rick Mullen stopped by and gave us a rundown on the films that will be on screen Saturday and Sunday.
We're a short film festival. That means all the films are 30 minutes or less, which is kind of cool because if you see a film and you go, I don't really care for much for that, well, just sit still, because in another couple minutes, a different film, a very different type, is going to be showing. So that's especially true Saturday at 1 o'clock when we have our short shorts. Those are films that are around 5 minutes, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. How can you have a film that has a story and an idea and characters that you care about and does it all and wraps up with them on 5-6 minutes? But these films really do. And so in about just under 2 hours, you're going to see a dozen or more very fast films from all over the world, with very different styles, animation, drama, comedy, horror, great stuff. Short shorts at 1 o'clock on Saturday. And then at 4 o'clock, we're going to replay some of the best of the documentaries that we were able to get in before the blizzard hit. We had a big turnout for that. We had a tremendous showing of documentaries, and we're going to show some of the very best starting at 4 o'clock on Saturday, including the winner, which was the film produced by some North High students and faculty, A New Tomorrow Begins Today, about diversity and equal rights here in Sioux City. And that actually won the audience award, and they won the trophy for best documentary and a $1,000 prize. So you'll have a chance to see that film Saturday at 4 o'clock during selected documentaries. And then, as I mentioned, of course, Saturday at 7, horror and sci-fi night. Ooh.
I love horror and sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
These are short as well?
Every film is 30 minutes or less. Quite a lot of them are 10, 12, 15 minutes. One of the films is actually, I think it's about 25 minutes long, with amazing special effects. We think it was actually designed to be the first film in a series, or first show in a proposed TV series. So it's got some name actors in it, great special effects, great sound and editing. It's a lot of fun. So we have no idea if it's going to be turned into a series, but you'll have a chance to see it here in Sioux City, and you can't see films like this anywhere else.
You also have a screenwriting seminar.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. We've got a lot of talented people here in Sioux City. One of them is Adam Goncharowski, who is a member of the Writers Guild of America. He got his degree in California and became a guild member, and he's a voter in the Academy Awards. And he will be putting on a one-hour presentation on Sunday at noon about how to write a good short script, something that people will actually care about. Because we've learned over the years, when we view all these films to pick which ones to show at the film festival, if we don't care about it, even if it's a beautiful film, if we don't care about the characters and the story, the audience is going to care either, so we don't choose those films. So he's going to talk about how to write a great script and how to make it work in a short time. So that's at 1 o'clock, or that's noon on Sunday, actually.
And then at 1 o'clock, a Best of the Midwest?
Yeah, that's a new category this year. Over the years, we've featured films from all over the world, all over the United States, but we've noticed there's quite a lot of them that are produced here in Iowa, as well as in Nebraska, South Dakota, Minnesota. And so that's what we're going to be showing. For a couple of hours, we're going to show the best films from Iowa and the states around Iowa that have been submitted. And again, unusually high quality stuff. Kind of surprising, really, when you think about some of these folks that did it. Some of them are from college students, some of them are from kids, but there's also some high quality production stuff and things that people are able to do now on their iPhones and even on their computers that have astonishingly good stories and good production values, and they're films you care about.
And then on Sunday night, you're having a festival showcase. Is that like the best of the fest?
It kind of is, yes. We will be re-showing some of the very best from the other genres that we've had, plus some of the other films that were submitted for that showcase only. You know, when people submit their films, they pick where they want them to be played, and we judge them. We prejudge them, I should say, so that we pick just the best films. So the festival showcase is the best of all of those. And again, like every night and after every show, the audience will vote on which film they think is the best. So it's kind of important when you're sitting there paying attention, which film do you think is the right one? Which one should get the trophy and the $1,000 check? So we will be having a vote after each of the screenings, and we will announce the winners. And at about 9:30 or so Sunday night, we will have an award ceremony and announce the winners of all the different genres and award the Susie Awards, the prestigious Susie Award, and the $1,000 checks to the winners. And, you know, fun thing about this festival is that a lot of the filmmakers are going to be there, which means they're going to be sitting in the audience with you. And at the end of the showing, we're going to ask them to stand up and come up to the front of the audience, and people will be able to talk to them and ask questions. And it's really kind of a very different and really fun thing to do.
It seems like these smaller film festivals have become more important over the years. It used to be there are only big film festivals and people really cared about getting into those. It does seem like the smaller ones have more importance now.
Yeah. You know, if you want to go to the Sundance Film Festival or Tribeca, you've got to spend many, many thousands of dollars and try, you know, fight to get tickets. Here we're selling tickets for $5. $5 to get in, or if you want to stay for the whole day, it's $10 for the whole day. And you get to go to the Stony Creek Hotel and Conference Center, sit in a very comfortable room with great seats. We've got two large digital screens in that room. We're installing a really great sound system so that you're going to be able to see the films, you hear them in great clarity and in a comfortable setting, plus, best of all, free Jolly Time popcorn. And you're not going to get that at Sundance.
That was Rick Mullen of the Sioux City International Film Festival. The festival runs Saturday and Sunday at the Stony Creek Hotel and Conference Center downtown. That's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Allie Carson, Mark Munger, Steve Smith, and Rick Turner. Join us next week when we talk to several Siouxland leaders about tolerance and how to promote it in our community. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.